Dr. James Beard, conducted on March 12, 2003. Okay, the first question I'd like to ask you today is to comment on the collection that you'll be donating to the university. Maybe comment on its scope and how you put this collection together, the criteria you use, and other things that may be relevant to understanding how this collection came into being.
Well, I don't recall for exactly, but it probably started around 1963 when I initiated plans to write a book on turfgrass science and culture. It was the first book that was written based on referenced research, what was available. And the research was published in widely scattered journals, conference proceedings, field days, etc. And so a great deal of time and cooperation of the Michigan State University Library at the time was in obtaining these materials either directly or through interlibrary loan. Knowing particularly the proceedings, field days, some of the older materials, no one was collecting them. Obviously, there's a tendency they get thrown away, particularly with the death of the individual professional. The spouse tends to not be interested in keeping that type of material, and a lot of it disappears in the trash. And without collectors and not having any value at that time, there were no efforts really being to develop a group of literature on this subject area. Libraries were lucky to have 2 foot of shelf space devoted to the subject area. One of the reasons was at that time there were very few turf majors at universities programs where they offered a turfgrass major study area. Many of those didn't evolve till late 60s, early 1970s, so there was no reason for the libraries to be emphasizing any of this material. So I began to write and collect as much as I could find, and it was a long process of identifying. As you would read in one article, you might pick up some references to another source, and then you would chase it down. And there were no computers, of course, and it was slow correspondence. And sometimes you try one person and couldn't locate any in that individual's area of sphere of activity, and so you would keep trying others and hopefully eventually find some of these. And there are proceedings with research papers in of organizations, for example, where they don't even have a set collection themselves. Nobody ever took the time to do that, and now many of them are, and finding they just aren't available. I got into general turfgrasses, and some of the literature, the only source for some of the physiology literature was in forage research. And that's where many of the turf researchers came from originally. They were forage researchers and then became part-time turf researchers and eventually full-time. So I was also collecting in the forage area, although I don't have a far from complete collection there. I'd say a modest collection. And then over time of 40 years, I've been able to bring together the largest collection of turfgrass literature of a scholarly research, technical, and popular article. In other words, the whole spectrum of publications on the subject of turf grasses, ranging from lawns to sports fields to recreation areas, golf courses, roadsides, ski slopes, cemeteries, parks, a wide range of areas, and moved eventually into the international area and collecting there. I started the first international turfgrass research conference in 1969, and that allowed me to, no one was talking to one another, knew one another internationally, allowed me to get the contacts to start to accumulate the international literature as well. That was held in, the conference was held in Harrogate, England. It was formed by Americans, but we were afraid if we held it in the United States, which was the most capability was here, nobody would come. So we felt we had to go to them in Europe, even between across Europe from England, Sweden to Netherlands to Germany, where there was some activity, they weren't even interacting with one another. So we were thinking that first conference, if we got 20 people, we had a successful conference. And it was set up with a program and some research papers and general papers of research summaries of adult education, of formal education programs to give perspectives of what's going on in the various countries. We had 62 people attend that first conference in Harrogate, England at the Old Swan Hotel. And our cooperator in England was Sports Turf Research Institute in terms of the local hosting. That most of the work was done in this country, and actually Harriet and I paid out our own pockets the original postage and correspondence and announcements and everything to try to get it started. It's now very successful, meets every 4 years with attendance ranging from 350 to 450, and meetings now on all continents essentially, except South America, and that's going to be meeting in Chile coming up in a few years. So that's kind of the background on the international dimensions. Formal textbooks, the collection is not that old by rare book standards. The oldest book, and it's more of a booklet, dates from 1892 that I know of existence. The first formal, that was in England, the first formal book was published by Leonard Barons in the United States in 1906 by Doubleday. It's oriented to lawns with one section in the back on putting greens, interestingly. It shows a steam-powered lawnmower in there that weighed 2,000 pounds and cut 30 inches wide. Some interesting things like that. There was also in 1906 a composite book edited by Horace Hutchinson that was published on golf architecture, design, and maintenance. So those are the two earliest formal bound books, if you will. The bulk of the publications over the years have come from the United States, literature-wise. But there are a lot of interesting books, particularly from England, that fit in and throughout the time frame. The longest continuously published trade-type booklet is the Scotts Company's Lawn Care, which started in the 1920s, and is interesting in that it kind of gives the history of the evolution of the American lawn. Very good. This wasn't what it was intended for. It was an educational piece, but it really is interesting to read and follow. It was so popular in the 1960s, early 60s, I forget, one of the universities made a study of readership and how many readers read the entire publication and what percentage and that type of thing. And they compared all publications, and Scott's Lawn Care magazine was on top, at the top, ahead of Time and Life magazine and all the rest. It was a very well read and sent out to many millions of people at one time. Other unique publications of a long-term nature would, of a pioneering nature, would be the United States Golf Association's bulletins. They are very rare finds, if you can find them. They are put out monthly, summarizing their research activities and some field observations of informational nature. And it was amazing how right they were in many cases. A lot of times the research wasn't even replicated. It was more demonstration plots. But they did generate quite a bit of information from those. And that is a very interesting historical reading as well. Those are just some of the individual pieces. In my collection, I've been fortunate to evolve till there are about four books in the turfgrass area that I do not possess at this point in time. All are golf-related books of an old nature that are in the $5,000 range and up, because golf collectors collect these types of things, and that raises the price, particularly when there are not too many copies around. Fortunately, Michigan State University Library just in the last year did purchase one of those. I looked at the price and said, not for me. There's one from South Africa. The one that the university just purchased is from 1912 in Scotland, golf oriented. And so I think with time, the effort is done in this library between my collection and what they're collecting already and been here, this should be a very complete representation of the literature in the turfgrass area. The other dimension of how the library started here, obviously I was writing and asking the library to collect and purchase a lot of this material. And Dr. Richard Chapin was director of the library at that time, and I must say he was very cooperative within his budget restrictions. And then I was lecturing at a symposium sponsored by the City of Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Sewerage Commission, which is one of the old fertilizers, one of the early ones developed in 1932, still sold to this day. And they had a very active education and some research program for the part. And a gentleman by the name of Mr. O.J. Knorr was the agronomist for most of those early years, who collected extensively in the turfgrass area, particularly in proceedings and mimeographed material and this type of thing that you don't find normally in libraries, but where a lot of the turf information was emanating from at that point in time. They took me to the library office where this was located, and Mr. Knorr had just passed away a few months before. And they said to me they didn't know what to do with it, that they had offered it to the University of Wisconsin, since Milwaukee was home state where the university was, and they wanted $50,000 a year minimum on a long-term basis to assume the responsibility for that. And at that time, the Knorr Foundation, which does gift money for research around the country, just didn't want to spend that much of their corpus in that type of a commitment. And they didn't have enough income for that. So they were wondering what to do with it, and I arrived and looked at this and knew the implications of it. And as soon as I got back to Michigan State University, I headed for Dr. Chapin's office and told him what was over there and the importance of it and the significance of it. And we got together and made a proposal to the Milwaukee Sewage Commission, and they decided to give all that material, which now includes a tremendous collection of old slides as well, to Michigan State University, with the understanding that it would be held as a definitive collection that would be indexed, cataloged, and available for scholars and students that might want to have access to this material. That was the basis, and then after that, Dr. Watson of Toro, Mr. Tom Mascara, West Point Products, Dr. Gilbert, with AmCam Associated Penn State University, all gave significant collections, and it started to build from there until at a point then a formal room was set aside for the collection. One time it was just stored away, most of it, and it is now USGA has got involved in funding of the automated retrieval system and the abstracting of literature, and it's become extraordinarily important source of technical information in the turfgrass subject area.
Do you have any manuscript material in this collection?
Yeah, the gifting from me will be include all my correspondence and writings over the years, including drafts of my manuscripts. I don't have any of any other authors in my collection.
About how many titles would you estimate are in your collection?
We're just starting to put that together. I don't really know at this point in time. It's not extraordinary numbers because there isn't that much, but there are many books that on the market are in the 2,000 to 6,000 range, and some up to 10,000. I have, for example, an original Sinclair, which is one of the first books in agriculture from the early 1800s. I have many leather-bound gardening books from the 1800s that I purchased mostly in England in the 1960s. I have a book by Curtis on grasses that in the back is a section on what became the concept of evolution of plants and animals. And Darwin, credited with the origin of this in his writings, says he got the idea originally from which this evolved from Curtis's book, and I have an original copy. In that are hand-painted lithographed drawings of the grasses. I have a number of books that have hand-painted drawings of the grasses from older times in them, which are extraordinary.
Obviously, this collection will be useful to people interested in turfgrass. What other kinds of researchers do you envision might find their way here to delve into the collection?
Well, there are in the since the 1970s, in the area of environmental stress physiology research, the issue of doing studies of that type versus traditional crops where there's a flower or an ear or a pod or something that's formed, a flowering type plant. It really, if you're trying to study the effect of the environment on the physiology and seasonal effects, it's really disrupted in terms of the metabolites and where they're going, to what parts of the plant that is, or where they're partitioned by that change from a vegetative to developmental stage. And even if I had not been, my main areas of interest is in environmental stress physiology of turf grasses. But even if I had that challenge in, as just a biologist, a perennial turf grass would be an ideal plant to do that type of research in, because it remains in a vegetative state. So you don't have the interference with the developmental flowering ear formation stage, which really makes it complex. And as a result, as we started to get do a lot of research in this stress physiology, 1970s, 1980s, we had a lot of people from other plant-oriented sections or subject areas that would come to our turf grass meeting to listen to our research papers at the Crop Science Society, for example, because we were doing some of the forefront of work, because of it was easier to do than in other types of plants. So all of that literature would be and theses and things from not just Michigan State, but other universities would be in here as well.
What about non-scientific interest in the collection?
Well, certainly, the role of turfs and landscapes in general in quality of life of modern societies. I was bothered for a number of years, even after I got my PhD. I wanted to do research to help people and teach. And you were told pretty regularly, you're working with turf grasses. That's not important, like food and fiber. And you were reminded of that regularly and kind of put at a lower classification as a scientist and scholar. And then once I began to travel around the world and observe the use of grasses and ornamentals and see the association with those civilizations that have developed a good economic base with relative social harmony. I can't say it's a cause and effect, but certainly a very, very strong relationship. And it settled in my mind that I was doing research and education that certainly is helping people in terms of the mental health, social harmony, productivity, in modern society, and particularly fast-paced urban areas where otherwise you're looking at nothing but concrete and asphalt. I should mention, of course, to acknowledge that there are other important benefits of turf grasses in the functional area that go from the most effective, cost-effective surface for erosion control, soil erosion and wind erosion, of water entrapment and groundwater recharge, of a biological system that's one of the most active in the degradation of organic compounds, including pesticides and all kinds of runoff contaminants from urban areas, from oils to cooking materials to all kinds of things. Very effective in the decomposition there, to heat dissipation through evapotranspiration. Urban areas typically run 11-12 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than adjacent rural areas, And certainly those cities with green areas, both trees and grasses, are very important in partially alleviating the heat island effect of urban areas. Certainly in terms of if water is not too short, irrigating a lawn and the transpirational cooling can greatly cut the costs for air conditioning of an internal residence if water is not limiting and costly. So that's, you got to put that qualifier on that. To noise abatement, a roadside with a 4-inch grass cut and 70 feet reduces noise levels in the order of 65% to 75%. To wildlife habitat, studies have been made on golf courses, for example, versus other adjacent natural areas or cropland. There are just more birds and animals on the golf course and, or park than any other area. They're usually irrigated. That means there are more insects and food sources on these areas. And unlike the accusations, the pesticides are not killing these animals off because the counts show they're there. And so wildlife habitat, a golf course, for example, only has about 25-30% of the area it's maintained intensely. All of its, the rest of it's mowed higher, not fertilized, frequently not irrigated, which with trees and water bodies that make it a nice habitat area for wildlife. There are other things like security in urban areas where you have visual pathways around a house with a lawn versus solid trees or shrubs where unwanted intruders can hide behind. Police will talk very much about this, wanting these visual corridors around residents. Highway safety, the grass vegetation along the sides of the road is a slow resistance barrier to slow vehicles down and that run off roads. That is something most people don't think of. It reduces the habitat and intensity of a lot of nuisance pests like rats, mice, snakes, ticks, mosquitoes, these types of things. And of course that gets into Lyme disease and West Nile disease and bubonic plague and a whole bunch of other things that are sensitive in this day and age. And they just don't come out onto these open areas. They stay more in higher grass or shrub areas. And so certainly where children or people are involved in recreation outside around the home or other areas, grasses is a natural surface and a safer surface. Recreationally wise, for sports turf, for example, versus, say, artificial turf, it's the safest surface on which to play, far less injuries. It provides the avenue for recreation and exercise and physical health that are important in a modern society. So you could divide them into functional, recreational, aesthetics, really what I'm doing. And it's a pretty impressive list when you start to put it all together. One that's not talked about is carbon sequestration. A lot of publicity about the trees in the tropics being cut down and where they're holding, wood is holding the carbon in. Actually, the grasslands, native grasslands of the world, and the roots decomposing in the black soils underneath with their organic matter content, which means carbon, is a far greater sequestering source for carbon as it affects global warming than the trees of the equator are. Another one I don't remember whether I may have talked to you about this before, but human diseases. Did I discuss that with you? I was approached at one time by the Botanical Society of Beijing and myself and a tree and a shrub expert, and they were interested in revegetating the city that had been bare ground and dust for many years because in the Red purges of the communist regime introduction, they cut down the trees and got rid of the grasses because those were symbols of capitalist societies. And so they then had large crews of people every morning sweeping the dusty areas and urban settings. They started to find in this environment of non-organisms, for the most part, a major increase in human diseases of many types, particularly respiratory, in their big cities that wasn't occurring anywhere else in the world. And then the dust on the roads and the visibility and roads and traffic safety and this type of thing, where no visibility drive vehicles at times. But the big one was human disease, and they wanted to investigate revegetating Beijing and eventually the other cities. Their philosophy was that the organisms, the dust-borne organisms that cause these diseases, is a much higher exposure. There is not the antagonists in the soil and vegetation to attack and keep these disease-causing organisms at more moderate levels in terms of human exposure, and that they needed to revegetate the cities to reduce their rate of increase in disease problems among humans in the city. And they started mostly with trees. That didn't have much effect. When they went to grasses, that's when they started to see the major effect, because it's a grass soil continuum with a lot of the organisms, both antagonists and fungi and bacteria and viruses that are in the soil, but living off of the root, fine, fibrous, dense grass roots growing in that soil, and having a protective vegetative cover over the top or part of that continuum.
I wonder if you could offer some comments on turf as an industry, both nationally and internationally.
Most people don't realize the magnitude of the industry, perhaps because it's around us all the time, from the lawn at the hospital where you're born to the yard at your home to the sports fields you play on for recreation in parks to lawns around the businesses and dining establishments and everywhere in terms you go to the cemetery you're buried in. Grasses are there. It is a much larger industry than most people realize. To give you an idea, a couple of years ago, in terms of dollar value expended on maintenance, it surpassed the income from the cotton industry in Texas, which is very, very large. Now, that doesn't count the value of the turf itself and its beneficial effects that I've talked about. This is just the amount of money spent on maintaining these areas. And it doesn't include the value of homeowners who mow and maintain their lawns themselves. So it's an industry that employs a very large number of people and offers them income and continuing to grow at a vigorous rate. Internationally, the same thing is happening in those countries which have an economic base, usually from an industrial society, that allows them enough money to afford an improvement in their environment in which they live, the quality of life, if you will. Fortunately, not all countries can afford turf grasses, and the quality of life suffers as a result of that.
wonder if you could also offer some comments on your work internationally. You've mentioned some about conferences, or maybe some other things there, but institutions you may have taught at, countries where you may have done some consulting, or whatever.
I think the most important thing I did was to start the International Turfgrass Society, and which is held every 4 years, a International Turfgrass Research Conference, which opened up the communications around the world of research and exchange of information that has upgraded everybody's understanding and activities in the field. Even in the classroom when I'm teaching to lecture and talk about conditions and problems in other parts of the world, sparks interest in the students to have this international perspective, and I see it in their end of their semester reports, and it's commented on. Personally, I have been in a position to have been the first to lecture on turf grasses from the United States and science bases in many, many countries, from as a university person. There have been industry people that have given lectures in a select few countries, but from Singapore to New Zealand to Australia to Kuala Lumpur to Buenos Aires in Argentina to South Korea to Austria, Italy, South America, or correction, South Africa, Israel, I guess what, Portugal, Greece, Sweden, I'm sure there are more, those are just the ones that come to mind. And it's opened the doors for them to realize the amount of education, of information is available. It's not available within these countries, and now there are a number of other Americans that are being invited over to talk at conferences at these places. In the 1995 to 2000, I was giving lectures, invited anywhere from 20 to 25 countries a year. The hunger for information is just unbelievable. One I remember is Kuala Lumpur. 300 people in a room, lectured 8 hours a day for 3 days, and not a person got up and left. Just tremendous need and desire. Part of that is the turf industries are expanding. People are wanting turf, and they need the technical knowledge behind that. And so it's been very personally rewarding to help people in other parts of the world, because no doubt about it, 80 plus percent of the research, and maybe close to 90% of all the turf research in the world is done in the United States. So it's fortunate I've been involved in helping share that in the rest of the world and help them grow in terms of decent quality turf grasses that will function in enhancing the quality of life and as recreational surfaces for sports fields, etc.
Are there any international universities that have distinguished turfgrass programs?
International universities with distinguished turfgrass programs, very few. The where they do have significant ones currently, Italy has, but that's funded by Italian Golf Federation, not through a university. There are a few university professors that cooperate, particularly from the University of Pisa and the University of and one or two other universities, but particularly Pisa, in I have contracts guiding research in a number of different countries where I have 10 or so full-time BS people and a couple of master's people doing research in those countries. Most of that money is coming from organizations and not from through universities. Some government money, basically I'm training on how to do turf research, and in time they can assume responsibilities, and some already have. Other programs, one is in Sweden with the Golf Association there. Germany did have a program, but it's declined quite a bit. France did have, it's declined. Japan has a significant amount of research funded, again, mostly through the golf work groups. New Zealand has a pretty good research program, again, funded by the golf and bowling green groups there. In Australia, they've been pretty bumpy up and down, and a number of their institutes have closed down. There's only one, and it's a new one in up in near Brisbane. And I was invited in there to serve as advisor in the startup of that research effort there, as I have in a number of countries in Kuala Lumpur and Italy and Korea, South Africa, Buenos Aires, and others, where at one time or other, in one of my visits, the main function was to go in and advise them on how to set up and fund a research program.
Jim, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about your family and how you as a family have worked maybe in your career. And
I was married early to the girl on the adjacent farm, Harriet, as my wife of 49 years. And she's been the most important person in my professional career. And for many years, we worked side by side. In terms of research and grant proposals at universities and educational programs to writing of books, they're just not the secretarial help at universities that I've been at through. And basically, my wife has done most of that work over there, even at the universities where the university should be doing that type of thing, grant research proposals and research reports and field day reports and field day announcement mailings and all the rest. Not all of it, but the majority of it's been done by my wife. And then she's been very closely involved in all the book writing, all 7 books, and was co-author on one and will be co-author on 2 more coming out in the next couple of years. At great sacrifice, not always totally harmonious at times when I'm trying to get something done fast, but overall a very loving and personally rewarding relationship. And it continues to this day. We've got a number of projects. She's here in the library with me today, working on literature searches for the revision of Turfgrass Science and Culture. And in terms of family, I have 2 sons. One is a golf professional, got his business degree from Texas A&M, and his name is Jim. And he's actually now has the head pro job at the main golf course in Bryan College Station, Texas. So the granddaughter is close, and Harriet likes that in particular. The other son is in the area of physical therapy, and his name is John Walter, and he is living in the northern Houston suburbs. He's 10 years younger. He's still trying to build that professional business up.
What's Harriet's maiden name?
Harriet's maiden name, Harriet Jean Coon, C-O-O-N. C-O-O-N. And we did grow up on adjacent farms. Went to separate schools because the school line separated, but did go to the same church. And she's a very good singer and a soloist, and had formal voice training. And I do a little bit of singing, so we'd sing in the choirs together as well at the church. And the small rural church we went to was my great grandfather built. Was a carpenter and contractor that built that, a rural farm contractor that built the church, and it's still there. And that's where we were married as well.
What would you do differently if you could do anything differently in your career?
What I would do differently, you never know. I started out, I wanted to farm, basically, and really wanted to get into farming, but just didn't have the economic base of land to do that. When I took those economic courses in college, I found that out. The one that's always intrigued me, I love zoos, and whenever I travel, I go to zoos. I don't know whether I would have been a good zookeeper or head of a zoo or not. Those are just things you don't know. And when I was growing up and choosing a profession, I didn't even think or know that such things existed, you know. In terms of doing differently, I think I would have said no more often to all the requests, and particularly all the requests and what's called extension to respond to letters and phone calls on a one-to-one basis, which take up a lot of time. Problem was, particularly at Michigan State, there was no one to do that. There were no extension specialists in turf. It took a lot of time away from my research and my teaching. But I had no appointment, but I felt there was a need there, so I did it. I could have done a lot of, not more, things in my assigned area where I was getting paid for and where I had to be accountable to if that part had not been there. And yet, how do you say no to people that really need the information and there's no other source? It's maybe a wishful thing, but maybe not a realistic thing if you're trying to help and service people. When I was here, and of course I authored two extension bulletins, one on lawn care and one on lawn establishment. If you compare the numbers distributed per year on those two bulletins versus all the rest of the extension bulletins, Michigan Agriculture Extension Service, the lawn bulletins exceeded those. That shows the demand for information and the pressures there were to be involved in the adult education aspects.
Okay, you mentioned just a minute or two ago the importance that some leaders in the Michigan Turfgrass Association played in enabling you to undertake research here at Michigan State. Could you comment on that, please?
There were, if five or six key people at that time, senior people in the state, mostly golf-related, that the main conference in the Midwest was the Purdue Turfgrass Conference. That would draw 350, 400 people. It's where everybody in Michigan would go to. Michigan had a conference, they'd draw 30, 35 people. Field day was like 15 people. At Purdue, it was 200, 250 people. I was a graduate student at Purdue. I was fortunate that a major professor gave me great responsibilities in the research area, not just my own thesis, and therefore was lecturing at the conference, giving talks the field day, and these people from Michigan knew me and had observed me. And they worked hard and got a turf position opened up here. And then they made a visit to Purdue and gave me a sales pitch. That's why I needed to come to Michigan State University. And they were a very forward-looking group, and they knew what they wanted for the state and what the problems were. They offered me a $6,000 operating budget, none essentially from university, some old beat-up turf equipment. I had no turf plots, I had no lab, and I had no lab for 5 years until I got a National Science Foundation grant to build a physiology laboratory. So a lot of my early work was field work, and they continued to support me, and gradually the funding increased. And of course, what, it's up to hundreds of thousands of dollars now, but I've been long gone since that happened. But I was pretty happy with $6,000 at the time. That was, it helped me, and it was very important that per year to get started. And the other key dimension of that was that at that point in time, the pressure from associations when they gave money was to have field plots, variety plots, fertility treatments, and all the very practical applied dimensions. While certainly I did a significant amount of that, and it was needed in the state to a certain degree, they also allowed me to spend some of that money on more basic botany and physiology and get started in that area, unlike many other places. Maybe being at the right place and the right time was part of it. Being in a state with individuals in a leadership position that appreciated the potential contributions that could be made to that side. I don't know what the combination was, but that's what happened. And certainly the Michigan Turfgrass Foundation and its early leadership in the 1962, 63, 64, 65 period, and those names are on record, were very critical in the formative stages of my progress in contributing to science versus culture, or art of turfgrass culture, if you will.